We've been talking about how this series, this psalm series, is a lot like following a journey, following some kind of path. But then also when following paths, sometimes we get lost. Have you ever been lost? Like actually lost to where you do not know where you came from, you do not know where you're going, and you're just completely disorientated. Has that ever happened? That's not happened to loads of people. But if you've ever experienced that, it can be really terrifying because you have no idea what's going on. Dante, in his Inferno, describes this fear. He says, in the middle of the journey of our life, I found myself astray in a dark wood where the straight road has been lost sight of. See, we can be lost in our lives. That's exactly what Dante is talking about. We can be lost in our own lives. A human being left to themselves to walk a straight line, if there's no other kind of waypoints or you don't have your phone to GPS kind of thing, often most human beings just end up walking around in circles. We're not really good at kind of navigating this life without some kind of thing telling us where to go. We don't have a good internal compass. Now, if that's true of our physical walking, surely that's going to be true of our spiritual walking. When you're traveling somewhere and you feel turned around, that kind of disorientation that you feel physically, there's that same kind of thing that goes on in our hearts. We look back. Wait, where did we come from? I'm not really sure. We're looking forward. Like, where are we going to? I don't really know. But once we know where we've been, if we can know that, let's say, there's the path. That's the place we're going. Okay, so that means if that's the trajectory here, maybe we're going this way. Maybe that's the path. That gives us a little bit better of a sense of where we're going if we have an idea of where we've been. Michael Bond wrote a book called Wayfinding, which is a fascinating book. It's about, the subtitle is The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. And it's mostly on like neurological kind of stuff. But he has these really great quotes. I'm just going to read a couple quotes. One of them is, being lost is not the same as being depressed, but they share some of the emotional and psychological consequences. The distorted decision-making, the sense of alienation from all that surrounds you, the conviction that you will die. They also share language. Depressed people describe themselves as adrift, outcast, out at sea. If someone says, I'm feeling a little bit lost, you know, there's the same kind of language. Like, we're not really sure where the path is. There's another quote. It says, people who are truly lost are usually incapable of making decisions that could save their lives, and they may even think they're going to die. They lose their minds as well as their bearings. We don't know where we are. We don't really know who we are. We don't know where we are inside. Being lost is a really scary thing. And more than scary, it's harmful for us. Because if the way that we're on is lost, we're lost. If the way that we're on, whatever it is, if we're lost on that, that means we, ourselves, we're lost. Instead of charging ahead into the unknown along an unknown path, God wants us to wait, look back, and see where we are. Knowing where we come from, where we came from, also helps us to know where in the world we're going. Now, for everyone who follows Jesus, we have a story that we get to step into, and that's a little bit of what Psalm 124 is talking about. We not only have a new future, but we have a new past. We have a new history, and the way to here helps us navigate the way to there. If we know where we've come from, the way to here helps us know where this is where we're going. We look back in order to move forward. This not only helps us move forward, it keeps us rooted. We have a story. We have a foundation. We have something that we can like feel like we have a hold on, and we have a path, a well-worn path, where others have gone before us. We're not the only ones going through this. Now, these psalms, especially these psalms of ascent, they're kind of like waypoints along a path for us. They've been waypoints for God's people throughout history, and they're helpful for us as well as we navigate our own spiritual dystopia out there. It's easy to get lost here, but God wants us to find our way, to find the way, and to be able to find him in it all. So let's look at this psalm a bit. We're going to look first at those first five verses that describe the story of Exodus. And what we're going to find out is the Exodus story is our story. The story of Exodus is the story of these spiritual refugees in the Old Testament. It's the story of us spiritual refugees as well. God is on their side because and only because of that, he saves them to the other side. Now, if you're not familiar with the Exodus story, it takes place in the book that's easily named Exodus in the Old Testament. So that's you know, if you've been to Bible college, you get to learn stuff like that. Israelites, they're slaves in Egypt here in Exodus. They're doing manual labor, all the stuff the Egyptians don't want to do. God calls Moses to free these people so they'd be free to worship him. Maybe you've seen Prince of Egypt, you know that story, right? Moses goes to the Pharaoh. He says, let my people go. Pharaoh's like, nope, I like slaves. You can't have them. So Moses is like, okay, I'm going to give you some plagues. And Pharaoh's like, no. And eventually, Pharaoh eventually gives in because the plagues are so horrible. As the Israelites are leaving, they kick them out. Pharaoh's like, no, wait, I want them back. I changed my mind. I want to have these Israelites back as slaves again because free labor, it's free. So he goes to chase them down. So the Israelites, they get to the Red Sea. So the Egypt's over here. The Red Sea's over here. They're fleeing Egypt. They know the army's after them. But the thing that's in front of them is the sea. So they're caught between these two spots. It's an invading army that's going to destroy them because the Israelites don't have any weapons. But then the sea here that they can't swim through, and they would die. And that is what these first five verses are about. God parts the sea, the Israelites walk across, the Egyptians follow on that dry land across the sea, and God brings the waters back and swallows them up. The Israelites are now on the other side, they're free, and their enemies are swallowed up. And so here, in these first five verses, the songwriter here is looking back to something that they have not experienced themselves. They did not go through the Exodus. This is way past the Exodus. The Exodus was a long time before David and his time that this was written. It was the same distance for them as it would be for us and the Reformation, or us and Henry VIII, or us and Michelangelo. We don't think they're close, but they are. The writer puts himself there and not been on our side. It's like he's there. He puts the community there. It's not just him, it's everybody. The Exodus story is their story, not because it's chronologically close, but because it's spiritually close. And if we're in the same family as the author here of Psalm 124, then it's close for us as well. The Israelites who went through it all, that can be our story, not because it's chronologically close or geographically close, but because it's spiritually close to who we are. God's past actions get to be ours as we are spiritual refugees in this tradition, in this family. If you notice, there's a lot of us and them going on here in verses 1 through 5. There's us. It's used up loads. There's these other people. There's they. There's there. There are the Egyptians, and they are the Israelites. Without God on the side of the Israelites, they would have been just like the Egyptians. The only thing separating the Israelites from the Egyptians is God on someone's side. From not God's people to God's people because of God being present with them. Now, there are lots of ways that people draw wrong lines between some kind of us and some kind of them, especially in the church. The church is really good at this because we want to feel good about ourselves and we want to be self-righteous and think, we're like this, they're like that, and we draw wrong lines, right? It's really self-righteous. But here we see the only thing that can make in us and them isn't because of something we've done. It's something that God has done. It doesn't say because we were clever, we survived. It's like, no, because God did all this stuff. We were just passive recipients. God's presence with us is what makes a difference. And that makes us different as to those who don't seek God's presence. It's the difference between being swallowed up or being saved. Now, I'm not sure the background of all people here. I'm not sure the background of people who might be watching online. But this is something that anyone can get in on. There is no us and them in a way that prevents any kind of them being part of any kind of us. Anyone can be part of the us. Anybody can. And without God, all of us are swallowed up. So if the Lord had not been on our side, if the Lord is not within us, we have no hope. We have no hope. We can overcome anything because God in us allows us to go through anything. God on our side saves us to the other side. Jesus in John 16:33, you may have heard this before, says, in this world you will have trouble. It's a guarantee. Thanks, Jesus. You know, he's brutally honest, this Jesus. He's not going to say, now if you follow me, everything's going to be fine. No, he says, in this world there's going to be trouble. But the next thing he says, but take heart because I've overcome the world. Now, why should we take heart if Jesus has overcome the world? Well, that's great, Jesus, but I'm not you. I've not overcome the world. The only way that's actually good for us, the only way we can take heart is if we're connected to him, if he's present in us. And that's exactly what Psalm 124 is talking about. God in us allows us to go through anything. This past Sunday, I had some crazy, insane people over for the Super Bowl. The two best American football teams playing against each other. I also love how they call it the World Championship when it's a sport that only one country partakes in. But I say crazy people because the game did not start until 11:30 p.m. And some, the hardcore people didn't leave till like maybe 3:30, 4 a.m. or something like that on a Sunday night. So yeah, some people really love sport. I mean, here, there's a stadium in Las Vegas is where they had it. Thousands of people are in the stadium, millions of people watching it on TV, including the seven of us in my front room in the middle of the night. Every throw, every catch, every play, every time your team scores, you feel like you score. There's a part of you that feels like you're on the field there, that connects with the team. You're not there. You're not even on the team. You don't get paid by Kansas City Chiefs. You're just there. But there's a sense of joining in. Now, if we can feel connected like that to a sports team, we're all the more connected to a story, to a family tradition like this by being part of a Christian family. This is not metaphorical. This is not aspirational. This is actually real. It's not like it's kind of like we're connected to them. No, no, we are connected to them. This is not an if. This is the team we're on. This is the game that we're playing. And when we read these stories, what they get to be for us is a mirror for us. They get to be a mirror for who we are. They're our stories. This is who we are. And God's actions in the past give comfort to us in the present. So how does the Exodus story become our story? How do we get to be on God's side instead of some other side? It's only through what Jesus has done, with us being united to him, these stories get to be ours. And we are not swallowed up when the floods came. We get to be on God's side, the side where there's comfort, the side where there's freedom, the side where there's peace. And Jesus brings together these stories. He brings us into his story, and now all the stories of God's past actions get to be part of who we are. That's how God's actions in the past to others, like in this psalm and the Exodus, can be a comfort to us now. He makes it relevant as he makes it real. So if that's the kind of God that he is, and that's what he does, we should probably take advantage of that. We should be maybe a little bit more dependent on him than we are. We should desire to be more dependent on God instead of it being something that I know I have to do. I know I have to rely on God. It's like, shouldn't it be something we want to do because he's given us everything and he's the only one who can take us through whatever we need to go through. We have a really good father. He's taken care of us in the past. He's going to take care of us today. Why would we want to depend on anything else? If you look to how we've acted in the past, when we've gone through difficult stuff, when we've only relied on ourselves, it's not always super great, not always perfect. Maybe sometimes we've been all right, but it's not 100% great. Why then are we so determined to depend on ourselves and everything? Would it be possible to change just a little bit? Now, this isn't going to be overnight 100%. We're like floating in the air with God, dependence kind of thing. But surely we could probably give just a little bit more to him than what we have. Sure, we could transfer a little bit of our independence to him and be a little bit more dependent on him to come through for us. That's called trust. That's called faith. Now, we're not going to get there overnight, but if we grow a little bit and then next week, next month, next year, grow a little bit more, we have a trajectory of growing even more dependent on who God is. Now, one way we can do this is to make sure that we continue to share stories of how God's worked in our lives. If this is an encouragement to us, the Exodus story being a part of us, then the little tiny stories that we get to be played out in our lives, that's an encouragement to other people as well. Your stories, no matter how small, are meant to have the same kind of function as this psalm to us. Even something simple like, this thing was annoying me, I prayed about it, and now it annoys me a little bit less. Like, that's actually really encouraging. It didn't completely solve a problem, but you got through it in a way that you wouldn't have otherwise because you're relying on God. When we share these stories, it underlines where we place our trust. It's really good for us to tell these stories because it reminds us, yeah, actually, God is really good and God does work this way. But other people need that as well. Whether they're Christians or not Christians, sharing part of how God works in your life, everyone needs to hear it. Having a story to tell about your own journey in life, it helps us know the path that we're on, where we're going. Our stories are markers along the way, and they're not just meant for us because other people need those markers as well. So as we read this story of God rescuing his people, we find it is our story, and we learn to depend more on God, who's on our side, to bring us to the other side, whatever that might mean and whatever you're going through. And as we trust him to do that, we're going to have our own stories to share. We're going to, because God is always at work. And as we share them, others are encouraged to do the same. If the Exodus story is our story then, let's look a bit closer in how he rescues his people. And when I say his people, that includes us in this psalm, includes all of us who follow Jesus. So God rescues his people is what we find in the next three verses here. This is a psalm of rescue. The first part is specifically about the story of Exodus, but here it's a bit more generic, a bit more open on the traps that we find along the way as we follow Jesus. The metaphor kind of broadens out. Now, when we first come to follow Jesus, there is an initial rescue from life to death, from wandering around to walking with a purpose, from being a spiritual orphan to joining a spiritual family, from death to life. That's the biggest rescue ever. Previously, we would have been swallowed up by death. Now we're not anymore. Christ has swallowed that death for us. So now we're on the other side. We're experiencing life. That's the biggest rescue ever. And what happens is that initial one-time rescue leads to a lifetime of being rescued. A state of rescue all the time as we follow him. But as any Christian would tell you, once you follow Jesus, it's not like life is perfect and there are no issues. No, in fact, you're likely to become even more aware of the issues that are going on in your life. So it does get more difficult. So when Jesus says, in this world, you're going to have trouble, you're like, yeah, I am going to have trouble. So all the difficulties that come up, they kind of bubble to the surface, all the ones we've shoved down a bit. And we find out, ah, this is how cold my heart really has been. I haven't even realized that. Or this is actually really difficult for me to follow in this way because I really want to do my own thing. And so life becomes, in some ways, a bit more initially, a little bit more difficult. And there are traps along the way, as these verses tell us. There is a powerful force out there whose only desire is to not have you experience life, to keep you stuck in death, to ruin all the good things that are out there. And if you're in a trap, you can't continue to walk. You're stuck. So let's look at these traps for a moment. And even though I won't be quoting him directly, I'm stealing a lot of this from our friend Augustine, who's walked this path with us. This is, by the way, volume 1 of 6. It's fantastic. This is when it's like helpful to be a nerd. Like, I cannot wait to read more of this. So Augustine, his background was kind of doing what he wanted to. He saw prostitutes. He had a child. He kind of excelled in his area of scholasticism and kind of made it to the top and realized, actually, it's not enough. I need something better. And then he found Jesus. He read the Bible and he found Jesus. And so that, a bit of the background. So someone with that kind of background, talking about what it's like to walk the Christian life, there's a level of lived experience of having it gotten wrong for a while and enjoying having finding the right path. So some of the things that he says in here is that one sets a trap for an animal in order to kill it. That's why it's in verse 6, it says, not let us be torn by their teeth. Meat being teared by teeth is eating an animal. That's what you do when you trap an animal. You eat it. The traps that we encounter while on the way with Jesus are baited, as Augustine would say, with the sweetness of this life. There's some things that initially seem really, really good. And those are the things that kind of that we are drawn to in the traps of this life. Good gifts can be that way. But even good things, if we elevate them to the best things, they become really bad things. So they can be something really good. It could be something that looks great on the outside. Maybe something that doesn't look great on the outside, but even things that do, all of them can possibly be baited traps for us in this walk. When we contort those good things into like ultimate best things, we contort something that was first really good and into something bad. And comfort, I think, is a really good example. Comfort is a great thing. It's great to be comfortable. There's a reason why we all want to do that. Comfort in itself is a good thing. To be on the road with Jesus, though, sometimes there is discomfort. It's not always uncomfortable, but sometimes there is discomfort. And the trap of comfort doesn't look like a trap. It looks comfortable. And who doesn't want that, right? To make our home in this world is not following Jesus. Now, comfort in itself isn't bad, but when we chase after that first, comfort kills. Comfort is a killer. Comfort is a killer. It keeps us complacent. It stops us from risk. It also stops us from the path known as a life of faith. A life of faith requires a level of discomfort. Religion is not the opiate of the masses. Comfort is. Now, stopping at that trap means not progressing. Now we're not following Jesus. Now our hearts aren't pilgrim hearts. They're fatty. They're fixed. They're not going to move. And how are we described here in this psalm? We're described like a bird. I will promise I won't do any kind of Nelly Furtado impersonation. As a bird is a small creature, a fragile creature. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take a lot of strength to destroy a bird. If we are small and fragile, the best way to not get trapped is to just avoid them. Just avoid them. Don't fly as close as possible to the trap. Don't obsess over the trap. Avoid it. Sometimes Christ's voice is a lot like Admiral Akbar in Star Wars. It's a trap! Some of you guys know what that is. That's great. Yeah, you're nerds. Do what you need to do in order to stay on the path that leads to life. And that's different for all of us. Some of us are going to be tempted by something. Some of us not by others. And that's different for all of us. But do what you need to do in order to stay on the path. It's generally not very complex. It's not difficult figuring those things out. We know what those things are already. It's actually following through. That's the really difficult part. But we don't have to do that ourselves. We have a community of people who we should be sharing this stuff with that are going to help us keep us on that path. And also within that community is the Holy Spirit at work, helping us actually do it. So don't try and risk walking across the muddy bog. Go around it, even if it takes more time. So, I mean, if staying up late is going to lead to temptation, you're like, oh, every time I stay up late, I always do this thing. Just go to bed. That's an easy one. Who doesn't like going to bed? I love going to bed. If you're at your best getting up 15 minutes earlier to read and pray, if you're like, every time I get up 15 minutes earlier to read and pray, my day goes better. Just get up. It's not a rocket science. Just wake up. If having one beer always leads to 10 more, drink something else. It's not that hard always to know what to do, but of course the difficulty is following through. That's the difficult part. You don't have to do that alone. You're not meant to do that alone. And the good news is that we don't rely on ourselves. Just as we depend on God to rescue us, we depend on him to keep us along his path. The Holy Spirit in us has all that we need in order to do this. He's given us his church to be a group of people not only running the same race, but we need others cheering us on as well. The Spirit and the church, we should use them both, and we really have to. If we don't, then we will fall into these traps. You see, with this God at work, what we get to be is not torn. We get to be made whole. We get to stay complete the way that Jesus has made us. And the traps here, they're not just, we don't just avoid them, but it says here in verse 7, the snare has been broken. If you notice how this rescue is being talked about, we are not really active. We didn't break these traps. We're the passive recipients of this stuff going on. We're passive recipients of being rescued. We were rescued. We didn't rescue ourselves. How? Because our hope is in the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. If that's where we set our eyes, if that's where we set our hope, that's the path that we take. Back when I was younger, maybe a bit more fit, I used to go do a fair amount of mountain biking with my friends. In fact, there was a house I lived in, I think five of us or six of us all had these mountain bikes. And one of our favorite places to ride in Florida, you're like, are there mountains in Florida? Not really, but there's abandoned rock quarries, and those are really fun. And so this is a picture of one of those places called Santos. Part of the trail was an abandoned rock quarry here. So some really kind of nasty sections to Santos whenever we went out. Some people ended up getting like arm pads and things like that. The more crazy the terrain, the more we were up for it. We just loved it. It was a lot of fun. Logs, ditches, you know, jumps. I got the scratches and bruises and staples in my head to show for it. But the secret to staying on your bike, no matter what might come your way, especially once the path gets really difficult, the secret to staying on your bike is in your eyes. Because where you look, that's where your bike is going to go. Where you look, that's where your bike is going to go. Now, it's tempting that when there's a log in your way to be staring at that log, especially as you cycle by. If you do that, you will fall or at least get off the path. You have to notice the log and not pretend like it's not there, but you have to keep your eyes fixed on where you actually want to go. That's the way to actually avoid all the traps that might go on a bike path. If you keep your eyes fixed on the ground beneath you, there's any kind of ramp, any kind of thing going on there, you're going to fall. If you have your eyes fixed where you're going, the bike will follow. And of course, the same is true of our spiritual lives. That's what the Psalms all the time, I lift my eyes up to you, I lift my eyes to the mountains. It's like, where are our eyes? Where is our attention? That's worship. Worship is attention. Where is our worship? When our eyes are fixed on God, the maker of heaven and earth, no part of heaven and earth can keep us from him. Whatever comes our way, whatever trap, whatever boundary, whatever snare, God rescues his people. His people keep their eyes fixed on him. To fix our eyes on him means to orientate our entire lives around him instead of just making him just another aspect of our lives. Instead of just being like another slice of in the pie of life, he becomes the center, the things that all the other things get organized around. To fix our eyes on him means we hear from him. We're with his people, the church. We talk to him, the Bible, the church, prayer. It's not like rocket science. Of course, the pastor's going to say that. These are basics. Now, also, none of these are silver bullets to avoid difficulty. None of these are silver bullets that's going to solve your problems. And I've found actually many times in my life that God isn't always there to solve our problems as much as to give us what we need in order to be able to go through them. I wish it wasn't that way, because I wish he'd just solve the problems and wouldn't have to think about anything. But it's going through them that he gives us the ability to get through. So the basics of our faith, Bible, church, prayer, help keep our eyes fixed on him. If they're not fixed on him, we really ought not to expect to go through any kind of difficulty well. Maybe we will, maybe we won't, but we shouldn't really expect to. The way to avoid the traps of life is the Lord in us. And the more we engage with him, the more we're aware of his presence with us, his work in us, the more we're going to rely and depend on him. And when he does rescue us, we get to say in verse 6, praise be to the Lord. Praise God. That means telling these stories. It means sharing them with each other. They can be Christians. They can be people who aren't Christians yet. Really probably should be both. And a community that shares these stories is a community that praises God. So we get to not be swallowed up. We get to not be caught in a trap. We get to not be torn, but be made whole. This psalm is true and is only true through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. If Jesus did not come to this earth, if he didn't live, if he didn't die, if he didn't rise again, then this isn't true, this psalm. It's not true. The way this can be trusted is because Jesus paved the path through his cross. Jesus was swallowed up alive. Death swallowed him up, and in that process, death itself was swallowed up. On the cross, for everyone who follows Jesus, the thing that you need rescuing from most, death itself, was swallowed whole by Jesus. Death tried to take on Jesus. Instead, Jesus took on death, and now death is going to never take us down. It can't. It was Jesus versus death, and death was defeated. See, Jesus saw the trap we were in. He knows it better than we do. He saw the trap that we're stuck in. Our death is something that we deserve. We brought it on ourselves. We had no other way out. So he released us from that trap, and instead he put himself in our place. It's through Jesus' death and resurrection that we can be rescued from the flood of death and find ourselves whole and completely on the other side. Jesus' death and resurrection is it's also what enables us to be brought into these stories that we're reading about today. Jesus on the cross crying out, "It is finished." And as he does, he breaks the trap. The trap's been broken. It's no longer for us there. The jaws of death are forever broken for all who are in him. This is how God can be on our side. Because when we were on the other side, on our own side, we were up against God, the flood, the trap, all the kind of metaphors there, we were caught up in it. And God came to earth to be on our side, even while we were caught up in it. He identified with us, still identifies with us. He's always on our side, never not on our side. So if you ever wonder, I wonder if God's on my side. If you're seeking his presence, always, you are on his side. And there's nothing more he could have done to prove that to be true. He went through all of it. There's nothing more he could have done. More important than the Exodus story is that story of Jesus' life. It actually gives meaning to the Exodus story for us. We're connected to Jesus, his story, and his life. So as we look back to how God has rescued us, that gives us a trajectory. If that's where we've been, if that's where we were, and that's all that Jesus has done, and that's where we've been, then where we are now is a place of life, a place of being released from death. And we know that trajectory of love and grace that has brought us to where we are now, and that rescue that has led us here, means we can trust in that trajectory of love and grace in the future. So whatever might come, we always know we can trust in him. If he's delivered us from death, whatever it comes at us, whatever it's going to be is going to be less than death. But even if it was death itself, we can always trust him in it. For a Christian, our dependence on God leads to a radical freedom. If we know that's going to happen, we will always be cared for. We will always get all the love that we need, always the grace and all the compassion that we need. We're free to live in a way that's other people can't live. We're free to risk knowing our help is in the maker of heaven and earth. We're free to live a life of faith, depending on the Holy Spirit to come through, because he always does, and he always will. God rescues his people. And as we look back to the ultimate rescue in Jesus' death and resurrection, we look to this table in front of us. This table was here because he was torn. He was torn that we would be made whole. Isn't that amazing? He was torn that we were made whole. We were in pieces, and he makes us whole. As we worship and celebrate this reality,